Grace's casket was exhumed back in 1997 and it turned out there was no gun inside the bag that was placed in her casket, all the momentum that had been building Gary's case stalled out. That possibility of the gun, that was all that's keeping Gary's case going. It was the last great hope Gary had, because if something had been there, if there had been a gun, that would have provided something that Gary's case has never had: physical evidence. Because there was no physical evidence in Gary's case. When I say that, I mean literally there was no physical evidence, in the broadest possible sense of the term. We essentially know nothing that does not come from witness statements. And the little info we have about that crime scene is really just more hearsay. So what do you do in a case where you have no physical evidence and not even so much as a description of the crime scene? How can you ever say who is right and who is wrong, or what may have happened and what definitely didn't happen? It all starts to feel hopeless. You can't really rule out possibilities. You can't really say anything definitive about the crime scene, which means you can't really tell if any given witness statement is true or not. You can't compare it to reality, so how can you say which ones are wrong and which ones are true? And to make things worse, in this case, we don't even have police statements from the night of the murder. The only statements we have come from the days, months, and years after the murder, after witnesses had time to reflect or adjust or forget their stories. What Gary does have is the phone calls he recorded back in the 1990s. Unfortunately, this is an old case. Witnesses have died, they're no longer available, and those phone calls and those recordings provide the only glimpse we'll have of what the witnesses in this case might have said. There are calls from three people in particular that stand out to me. Three people whose calls I think give us some clue about what may have happened here. The first was from Ray Almond. He was a pallbearer at Grace's funeral, and after the exhumation, he talked to Gary and told him what he knew. The second was a guy that I've dubbed the Mystery Man. And the third was Beverly Reynolds, Grace's daughter, who had confessed to Grace's murder back in 1976. Back when Gary was trying to reopen his case, some of the calls he got were from people like Magdalene Culberson, people who thought they had bombshells to share with him, who thought they might have the key that could unlock the whole story. But others were much less optimistic about whether they had anything useful to share with him, about whether they knew anything at all that could make a difference.
I don't know what I could do to help you. Because the only thing I know is, you know, the facts before and after. I wasn't there during.
Yeah.
I just know before and after.
That's Ray Almond. He's passed away in the years since this call was made, but he's someone Gary knew and he was more or less friendly with. And he lived close to where Gary had moved up on Maple Street when he came back to Rome in 1974. He often hung out at Gary and Grace's bar and played poker at Grace's trailer, the one he set up to play poker in after the Newberry ladies had busted in their house and made poker games at the Maple Street house an untenable idea. But in the 1990s, when Ray Almond first spoke to Gary, he was reluctant to get involved. He'd been at Gary's house both before and after Grace was killed, but during that 45-minute time period when Grace was killed, he hadn't been there and he didn't know anything, or so he thought. But Gary was persistent. And finally, Ray Almond called Gary back and said, "Look, are you sure you want to talk to me? Because what I know isn't going to prove your innocence."
"I don't know enough to clear you on that."
"Okay."
"I know enough to just about put a reasonable doubt and all in there, but I can't clear you on that."
It seems to me that Ray Almond really thought Gary was probably guilty of the murder. He was skeptical, therefore, that anything he had to say could help Gary. But he also knew that the official version of events, the official story, that wasn't true either. What the state said happened didn't happen. And although the real story didn't make Gary innocent, if Gary was guilty, he was guilty in a way that's different from how the state claimed. But Gary told him, "Yes, please, talk to the PI anyway. I don't care. Anything you have to say to him, I want to hear." So Ray Almond agreed, and he called up Gary's investigator, a man named Larry Kellett. Unfortunately, Larry Kellett's recording is really terrible, and it gets worse as the recording goes on.
"Gary tells me that you might recollect some stuff about that that time his wife was killed?
Yeah, like I say, I was with him all that day up to a time when we came him home. I dropped off Bo and Tiny, and then I went on home, and hell, it wasn't 45 minutes till Charlotte come got me, and I got back to the house. Well, it wasn't 45 minutes to an hour, because I just had to lay down when she knocked on the door.
What did she say when she knocked on the door?
Said it did kill Mama after just sitting there.
According to Ray Allman, on the night Grace died, he'd been hanging out at Gary's gambling trailer all evening. And after they'd finished playing for the night, Ray had driven home Bo and his friend Tiny Hill back to Gary's house on Maple Street, where he dropped them off and went home. Now, Bo obviously is Bo Salmon. That's Charlotte's boyfriend, the guy who was living in the house with them and who was there the night Grace got killed. Tiny Hill, who you've probably forgotten, was Bo's friend. And as you'd probably guess from the name, he was a very large man. And I still don't know if Tiny Hill himself was ever involved in this case in any serious way. It's hard to say. It seems unlikely, but Gary himself, in his memories, he seems to recall that on the night Grace got killed, he got a call from Tiny Hill's wife. That's the only reason he went inside the house in the first place.
Okay, I didn't go on in the house when I got there. So I was sitting out there talking with Richard Hawkup. So Charlotte came to the door and says, "You got a phone call." I went to the phone and she said, "This is Tiny Hill's wife. He's got arrested for a DUI. Could you sign a bond?" I said, "No, I don't own any property." And that's when I went into the kitchen to get a drink. And then that's when the shot went off. And then everything from there was, as I said.
I don't know what to make of the story. As far as I can tell, there's no source for it. So I can't rule out that it's a real memory. At the very least, he didn't steal the story from any trial transcripts he's read. But whatever the deal is with that call, well, I can't rule out that Tiny Hill was involved in some way with the events of that night, because Ray Allman claims that Tiny Hill was hanging out with Bo just before Grace was killed. And according to Ray Allman, he dropped off Bo and Tiny Hill at Gary's house not long before the murder occurred and went home for the night, where less than an hour later, 45 minutes later even, one of Grace's daughters came to his door and gave him the news. Ray says it was Charlotte that got him, but that's not right. In the 20 years since this happened, he must have misremembered or something, because Beverly says it was her that went there. She went and fetched Ray Allman. And Charlotte says, too, it wasn't her. She didn't do it. But regardless, one of the girls fetched Ray, and Ray went back over to Gary's house that night, before Grace's body had even been removed. And according to Ray, he watched the police take out two men from the house in handcuffs. Bo Salmon and Tiny Hill. No, there is no other source that claims Tiny Hill was also arrested at the Maple Street house that night. And I don't know why Ray recalls this. But aside from the Tiny Hill stuff, which no, I can't make sense of, here's the part of the story that Ray remembers that really matters.
When was the next time you heard anything about it?
About 5 days later.
And who did he talk to?
Richard Holcomb.
Ray says he heard the story from Richard Holcomb, but Richard Holcomb, Bo's friend who ran poker games and who was at Gary's house the night Grace died, he claims he left before Grace was shot. He actually testified to this under oath at one of the habeas hearings. But according to Ray, Richard told him he hadn't gone in the house that night. As Ray told the investigator, Richard wasn't there. He let Gary out and left. And then he met Gary later that night. And after Gary picked up Sean and took Sean down to his daddy's house, then they got Gary before daylight that morning and all. Then Richard took the pistol and gave it to another guy, and the other guy threw it in the river. To break that down, Richard told Ray Allman that just before Grace had been killed, he dropped Gary off at home. And then later on, after the murder, Gary had gone and picked up his son Sean from the babysitters, and then driven over to his parents' house, where he'd apparently met Richard again and given him the gun used to kill Grace. And Richard had given it to a third guy who had tossed it into the river. I wish I'd gotten a chance to speak to Ray Allman to see if there was some way to make sense of this, because there's just so much he says to Larry Kellett that raises questions that can never be followed up on now. Like when he says that all he knows about Grace's murder is what Charlotte told him, and he didn't know what the police had said. So, Larry Kellett told Ray, Well, they said Gary had shot her, and that was it. Shot her 5 or 6 times. Something like that. But Ray responded to that, and then he was supposed to have turned her over and shot her 1 more time. Which Larry Kellett agreed to, which I don't know why, because that's not what supposedly happened. Why would Charlotte have told Ray about Gary turning Grace's body over and shooting her once more? That's not something that I've ever heard of before, other than this one statement. And maybe it's all made up by Ray. Or maybe Charlotte told that to him, in which case I want to know why. But if what Ray told Larry Kellett is true, then Richard Holcomb was telling people that he was the one who helped dispose the gun used to kill Grace. That's a big deal. Though, you can see why Ray Allman would have been skeptical that his story could help Gary at all. Because Richard's story doesn't make Gary innocent. It just makes things more complicated. But what Ray Allman didn't know is there's no way Richard's story is true. There's no way Richard could have met up with Gary after the murder at Gary's parents' house to hand over the pistol. The timing, logistics just don't work for that. That didn't happen. So if Richard had the gun that killed Grace, there's another reason that he ended up with the gun.
Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. It combines supportive memory foams to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. And with over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars, it's quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. Casper mattresses are designed, developed, and assembled all in the United States. And best of all, buying a Casper mattress is completely risk-free. Casper offers free delivery and free returns with a 100-night home trial. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Now, I can say I've tried several mattresses over the years, and the Casper is the most comfortable mattress I've ever used. And when, like me, you don't get that much sleep, every hour of sleep you can get counts, and the Casper mattress leaves me feeling great in the morning. And now, it can do the same for you. You can get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/undisclosed and using the promo code undisclosed. Terms and conditions apply.
That brings us to our second call. Back in 95 or 96, so still before Grace's casket was exhumed, Gary received another call, this time from Mystery Man. That's the name I've been using for him anyway, because I don't have another. Gary never knew who he was, and none of my guesses about his identity have panned out so far, so for now, he's just the Mystery Man. And one day, out of the blue, Mystery Man called Gary up. "You probably don't remember me," he said, "but I used to come to your bar. And I remember when you got convicted for Grace's murder. And I've got something I need to tell you."
"You know, my wife, she is beautiful and told me to stay out of there. She said she don't remember you. I do remember. Y'all were good people."
"Well, thank you. Yeah. I appreciate it."
"And it was just unreal."
"Well, sir, I appreciate it very much, and I promise you that..."
"Yeah, well, when it happened, you know, I was just like anybody else. That, they were, you know, you was in there, and you and your wife had a fuss or something, and you killed her, and you was drunk, and I thought, well, God, that don't sound like Gary."
"No, it was just amazing that they didn't... I didn't have a prior record. You know, I hadn't been in jail for anything. Traffic, I had a DUI, you know. I mean, I had never... been in there for violence or anything."
"Right. So she was seemed to be a nice lady too. In fact, it seemed like she could get a little temperamental quicker than you."
The Mystery Man had been surprised by Gary's conviction, but he hadn't doubted Gary's guilt either. Gary must have gotten blind drunk and shot Grace in a fit of rage, and that's it. These things sometimes happen after all. But then years later, Mystery Man heard something about Gary's case that shocked him. And he hadn't acted on it right away. It had stuck with him, though, all these years. And now he wanted to come forward. Because one night, years ago, he'd been in a bar room with a guy he knew. And Gary Reeves' name had come up.
"Somebody said, that's about like that Gary Reeves case. You know, he said he was drunk and don't remember nothing. And this boy spoke out about And he said Gary Reyes didn't do it. I forget how the subject come up. Somebody said something about your name, and I said, yeah, he's still serving time for that, isn't he? And it just, you know, they told me, so, no, he ain't serving time. He wasn't guilty.
There were two different men involved in Grace's death, Mystery Man had been told. And initially, Mystery Man tried to be all cloak and daggers about it. He refrained from naming anyone in his call, using, like, code names instead. The one who's in prison, or the one who's dead.
And at that time, they hung around down there at your place all the time together.
Yeah, they did.
And but he, the little one, did it for the one that's in prison. And I don't want to call wrong names, because you know who they are.
Yeah.
But the one that's in prison for a hit. He is paid to hit somebody.
And according to Mystery Man, the person who'd wanted the murder done, who'd wanted Grace killed, that would be the one in prison. That is Bo Salmon. But there was another man involved too. The one who's dead. That was the shooter, Mystery Man said. But before he died, the one who's dead, he talked a lot more than he ought to have.
This person, when he gets to drinking, he's got a loose mouth.
Oh, the one who's dead told this person.
So it would be hearsay, but the one that's dead, he's got a, you know, he played cards a lot.
Yeah.
And he'd tell how he cheated and everything.
Thankfully, eventually, Mystery Man stopped with the cloak and dagger stuff and started using the actual names of the people involved.
And he run with him all the time. Well, hell, I didn't know he used to keep no secret. You know who we're talking about. He run with Richard all the time.
Yeah.
Richard Holcomb, that is. And what I found significant is that at the time of this call, Richard's name hadn't come up in any reporting. There's no way someone who was just reading the news about Gary's case could have learned that Richard had any connection to it at all. But, according to the Mystery Man, he and Richard Holcomb, they'd had a mutual friend, and this friend had a tongue as loose as Richard's was.
I do know Richard. When he's drunk, he's got a loose tongue. He likes to brag, and he had told this boy that, and that boy told me that. And he told me, I said, well, what reason would he have to do it? He said, he didn't. He done it for Bo. He said, Bo was going with her daughter, and Grace was having a fit about it, wanted him to leave her alone, and so that Bo's name wouldn't be brought up in it and all that stuff is because he was known to be involved with it, and Richard wasn't, and Richard wasn't who done it for him, you know, as a friend.
But Mystery Man said that by the time he learned of Gary's innocence, it had been after Gary had been released on parole. And yeah, it had bothered him to learn that an innocent man had been convicted of something he hadn't done. But since Gary was free already, well, Mystery Man had put off taking the action himself. And then Gary's case hit the news. He saw the story on Inside Edition, had seen how Gary was still striving to prove his innocence. And Mystery Man began to question his decision not to come forward sooner. Finally, he decided to pick up the phone and call Gary with what he knew.
I've been debating this for a while, and it's got to be done. Somebody's got to do something.
I appreciate it. God knows I appreciate it. I don't know what I'd do.
Mystery Man was inspired to come forward in particular because he thought his story could help Gary prove his innocence. And although Mystery Man had never heard of the gun being buried in Grace's casket, he wanted to let Gary know that if he ever did succeed with getting the body exhumed, and if the gun was found, well, there was one person in particular whose fingerprint should be tested against the gun.
I mean, I don't know how you could actually prove it to open it up, just to, you know, open it up. And if the gun is in there, you probably more than likely you would find that person's fingerprints on it.
Okay.
Still, Mystery Man didn't want to attach his name to the story. He wanted to remain anonymous. But he also wanted to help Gary, and he was willing to take a chance to do so.
I'm trying to get the police department to reinvestigate it, but I'm having a hard time getting them to do anything.
If there was some way that I could remain anonymous, but say you have to have it, and I know you're an innocent man.
What about with my attorney? If my attorney, if you could tell her this and remain anonymous.
Yeah.
In the fear the mystery man had, the reason he wanted to remain anonymous, it said the person who was in prison, a.k.a. Bo Salmon, would not always be in prison.
We will make sure that you remain anonymous and your name will not be leaked out in any way to anyone.
That's the only way that I can do it because I have a... I don't want my family hurt in any way.
Yeah.
You know, the one that's in prison, one day he'll get out.
Mystery Man told Gary that he had no hesitations about being called a rat or a snitch, if that meant clearing an innocent man's name. Being a snitch didn't bother him none, but putting his family in danger, that he couldn't do. So Mystery Man never told Gary his name, but he did arrange for a time to go with Gary to see his attorney and to give her a statement about what he knew.
Well, could you meet us Wednesday?
Let me write this number down. Now, my wife don't know I'm doing this. I'm in the bedroom. That's why I'm talking low.
Yeah.
She told me don't get involved.
Despite his wife telling him to stay out of it, Mystery Man did show up at the meeting with Tammy Colston, and he told a story to her. Gary isn't sure now if Tammy actually recorded it or she just took notes. Mystery Man did offer to let them record it so that if they needed to, they could take it to a judge, but if it was recorded, Gary never got a tape, and Tammy Colston no longer has any files in this case, so if it was recorded, it's gone forever. But in that call, the one Gary recorded, Mystery Man said the reason for the murder had to do with conflict over Bo Salmon's relationship with Grace's oldest daughter, Charlotte.
And it was over her.
Oh, really?
Yes, it was. The one that's in prison was going with Grace was mad about it, wasn't going to stop it.
When I spoke to Beverly, she told me a story that was almost, but not quite, the same as what Mystery Man told Gary. It wasn't that Grace had objected to Charlotte and Bo going out together. The trouble had been when Charlotte had been planning to leave with Bo to go somewhere, or something like that. I don't understand all of Beverly's story because I don't think she understood it herself, but she told me that on the day her mother had died, Bo Salmon had wrecked his car, and for some reason, Beverly is not clear why, that part was pretty fuzzy, but for some reason, that wreck had caused Grace to learn that Charlotte and Bo had plans to run off together. And Beverly told me, I guess the wreck is what brought it to Mom's attention and stuff, and she asked Charlotte where they were going, and she said she was leaving with Bo. But I don't know where they were going, and I don't know the whole story, because I was left out of all that. So, it seems like maybe there was some kind of conflict about Bo and Charlotte and Grace not being happy with what they're up to, but this could also just be memories and rumors twisted by 40 years of hindsight. But still, Mystery Man felt certain. Gary was off track in blaming Grace's daughters for her death. They hadn't done it. Though, Mystery Man allowed, Charlotte must have at least known the truth of her mother's murder.
You know, you was talking about on that thing that the daughter done it.
Yeah.
She did not do it. But she's as well as involved as the rest because she won't complain.
So Mystery Man wasn't sure why exactly Charlotte would have accused Gary, why Charlotte would have said at trial or otherwise that Gary had killed Grace. But he said it wasn't a crime she'd done that she was trying to cover up. There was something else at work for why she'd covered up for what Bo had done.
I mean, he is cold.
So she would still be afraid of him?
Yeah. It's either love or
fear.
Fear. And that's why she's not coming clean.
Mm-hmm. And that brings us to the calls from Beverly and all the statements she made to Gary back in the 90s. In those calls, she'd talk at length at all manner of things, and yet sometimes I wonder if the best thing to do would be to dismiss all of it as meaningless noise. Because trying to make sense of Beverly's statements is probably a mistake, and I wonder, am I fooling myself if I think I can somehow pick out the kernels of truth amid the piles of meandering noise? Maybe. I don't rule that out. But for better or for worse, after talking to Beverly and after hearing her calls with Gary, there are two things I strongly believe. The first is that Beverly did not see Gary shoot her mother. And the second is that Beverly thinks Charlotte's lying to her about what happened that night. And to explain why I think this, I have to go back to Beverly's older statements, the ones before the recorded phone calls, the ones back in the 70s. Beverly's story has always been infinitely flexible, and she incorporates random and creative details at will or whim, it seems, almost as if stolen from a soap opera. That's why it's so easy to dismiss everything she says, because sometimes what she says is just nonsense. But there are some fixed stars in what Beverly has said. When she describes Grace's shooting, it always starts with her in her bed, on that back porch bedroom attached to the back of the kitchen. Just before it happens, her mother is always standing next to the stove, just on the other side of the wall from Beverly. What Grace is doing, that changes. Sometimes Grace is about to start cooking, sometimes she's lighting a cigarette, but she's always there at the stove. And then there's a gunshot, and Grace makes a small noise, something less than a scream. Grace falls, the shooter leaves the room, and on the way out, turns off the lights. Only after the shooter leaves does Beverly leave as well, walks out through the door in the kitchen, across to the dining room, where she finds her sister. And then she calls the police, though what phone she uses is one of those details that's often in flux. But if there are any parts of Beverly's stories that are true, I think it has to be those facts, the details she always goes back to. And looking at them as a whole, I think there is a way to explain that's why that's the story she sticks to. Because I think Beverly was in bed when the shooting happened. I think she stayed in her bed till it was all over. And when she was testifying at Gary's trial, what she was describing were the things she had imagined had happened, based on the things she'd really experienced. She wasn't a witness to those events herself, but she really believed that might be what had happened. That's the best and really only way I can make sense of Beverly's statements anyway, about how she's so consistent on some things and how most of her story is an ever-changing dream. But the story she told at trial, the one about her jumping out of bed when the gunshot happened, running to the kitchen doorway, and watching 3 or 4 or 5 more shots be fired, I really don't think that ever happened. It's the story she told the attorneys after Gary's trial, the one about seeing an unknown shadow in the kitchen. I think that one may be true.
All right, now you told the police that Gary shot.
That's all I knew.
All right, now why did you tell them that?
It just seems to me Gary could be the only one, because Gary's the only one I saw besides just a shadow.
Beverly's story about the shadow, the way she tells it, it's so fanciful and abstract, it's easy to see why it's often dismissed as just one of Beverly's stories. But I think this story may be literally true. She did see a shadow, or rather a silhouette. Because, see, Beverly's bedroom, the little one back behind the kitchen, that back porch, it had been tacked on there at some point, some kind of addition to the house, but the back window of the kitchen, the one that had once looked over the backyard, it now looked over the porch once that was added on. There was a curtain on the kitchen side of the window, and it was blocking off the window, so at least most of the view from the porch into the kitchen would have been cut off. But the white curtains didn't cut off light. Beverly told me about how, when that had been her bedroom, there had actually been 2 beds out there, one of them intended for her little brother. But Beverly would always sleep in the one in the farthest corner because that was easier to sleep in. There was less light into her eyes coming through that curtain. Which makes me wonder. Even if Beverly didn't run to the door to witness her mother's murder, could she have seen a part of it from her bed? Through that curtain window? In a sort of shadow play of her mother's death? Because if that's what Beverly saw, then perhaps that's why Beverly concluded it was Gary that was shooting her mother that night. All she saw was a shadow, and her brain filled in the blanks. I don't think Beverly was ever told to say that she saw Gary in the kitchen that night, because she didn't have to be. Like Beverly told Gary, she wasn't pressured to identify him as the shooter. That's just a conclusion she reached on her own.
From that night, the only thing I seen Gary in the kitchen, and that's just all that went in my mind. Nobody told me that.
There's no way now to know for sure, but Beverly's explanation makes sense to me. She thought the shadow in the kitchen had been Gary, so she concluded, not unreasonably, that Gary had killed her mother. No one needed to coach her into saying that. But this theory about what Beverly really saw that night, it's not just a theory. Because for years after the murder, it's exactly what Beverly claimed happened. Even at that very first post-conviction hearing, in April 76, Beverly said this, more or less. The prosecutor had asked her whether her trial testimony was true, and when she said it was not, she was asked what was not true about it. And she said, "I didn't get up to see it. I didn't see the shots." "Well then," the prosecutor asked, "what did she see?" "Nothing," Beverly said, until she came out and seen Mama on the floor in the kitchen. Later in that same hearing, she qualified, "There was a shadow in the kitchen. From where I was laying through the window, there was a shadow on the wall." The prosecutor also asked Beverly, "Well, if that's all she'd seen, the shadow, why had she said at trial that she'd seen Gary shoot Grace, if that wasn't true?" Beverly told him, "Because I wanted to believe that Gary done it." I don't know what exactly Beverly meant by this, and she wasn't asked to elaborate, but I think she might have meant what she said. She wanted to believe Gary done it, because that was easier and more appealing than having the answer be in doubt. Or perhaps it was easier and more appealing than some other answer that she thought might explain what happened that night. But she hadn't seen what she'd said she'd seen, and she wanted to get that sorted out now. The truth was, she said, "I don't really know who did it, but I don't feel Gary done it." Then, fast forward a year to the extraordinary motion hearing in 1977. Beverly testified again, and again she described how she'd seen the shooting, and claimed Gary had been there in the kitchen, but she saw this all through a little window and not the doorway. "I heard a gunshot," she said, "and I heard Mama scream, and I jumped back on the bed. I was scared that whoever was out there shooting her would shoot me. That's all that was in my mind. And I jumped up and I looked in the little window in the back room, and Gary was standing there with a gun. I jumped back on the bed because I was scared he would shoot me because I'd seen it." And she stayed there, in her bed, for 10 minutes after the shooting, until she'd finally crept out to the dining room. Finally, in the 1977 habeas hearing, Beverly gave the same answer about what she'd done during the shooting, that she'd hidden in bed. "I just couldn't go in there," she testified. "I couldn't move. I couldn't say nothing or do nothing. I didn't know what to do." She never did jump up to the kitchen door, she said. She didn't see what happened in the kitchen, and she'd waited 10 minutes after the shooting before she'd finally gone out and ran to the dining room. Although court transcripts don't show annoyance, I can't help but read that into the judge's tone when he asked her, "Well, what is your testimony here today? Now, what do you want this court to believe?" And Beverly told him, "It's just like I said at first. I don't know what really happened. I didn't see the murder." We don't have Beverly's police statements, so we don't know if this is true or not, whether that's really what she said at first. But it's possible it was. And if I'm right about what Beverly saw, what the reality is here, that she never saw a damn thing, then I can only imagine how frustrated she's been over the years, how trapped she must be by her later statements, because if that's the case, Beverly has told the truth before, repeatedly. Actually, every time she testified after trial, in 3 different proceedings, where she testified that she didn't leave her bed and that she saw everything she saw through the window. But no one ever seemed to believe her. And maybe that's why, whenever Beverly's implored to fix all this just by telling the truth, Beverly sounds, at least to me, bitter and a little scornful.
We're going to try to make it right. And remember what my sister told you years ago, that the truth would set you free.
The truth will set you free.
and that will take all of this off of us, both.
Maybe Beverly has told the truth in this case before, but the truth hadn't set her free at all. She'd had no more luck with the truth than she had telling lies. And at least with the lies, sometimes people have believed them. And that brings us to her calls to Gary. Because when Beverly called him back in the 90s, she could be all over the place. Sometimes she was sad, sometimes she was chatty and nostalgic, sometimes she was angry at all the shit she'd had to go through in her life, and sometimes she just sounds confused and puzzled about how her mother had died. But as confused as she often was, I think Beverly thought Gary was more confused than she was.
I don't actually remember. I don't think you remember. I think you've got that night that the fucking card game went on, and then women come up there confused with the night that it actually happened. Gary, I think you are confused.
But throughout her calls with Gary, Beverly never expressed a belief in Gary's guilt. She's unequivocal about the fact that whatever really happened, she never saw Gary kill Grace. That didn't happen.
I never seen you kill him.
Well, let's see if we can do that.
But as confused as Beverly might have been about things related to that night, there's one thing Beverly was strangely confident in, and that's that Bo Salmon didn't kill her mother.
But put it two and two together. The night that Mama got killed, I do not think Bo Salmon killed my mama. I sit on Bo Salmon's chest. I slapped him in his face. I jerked him up off that bed. The police did too. I think Charlotte. I do not think Bo Salmon killed my mama.
Beverly told me the same thing when I talked to her. Bo had been absolutely passed out and non-functional on the night Grace died. Beverly had seen that, as she put it, with her own two eyeballs. She had been frantic to wake him up, hitting him, yelling at him, shoving him, pushing him off the bed, but he hadn't budged. It had taken two police officers dragging him out bodily to get him out of bed and out of the house. So she'd ruled him out of any involvement in the case. He'd been dead to the world.
Kill my mama. I think I know. I don't think Bo Salmon pulled that trigger, Gary. I'm gonna swear Bo Salmon was knocked out. Passed out.
In her calls with Gary, Beverly often cycled through all kinds of ideas about what might have happened that night. What could have happened to the gun, who was involved. But her conviction was that Bo was not part of it. Beverly didn't consider Bo to be an option.
What do you think about that, Beverly? They're finding a damn sack in that casket. That ain't...
Honest God,
you know,
I think somebody dug her up before.
Yeah, I do too.
You want to hear my opinion?
Yeah.
I think the coffin had already been broke into. I think her vault has already been broke before they ever done it. And I think the doorway is covering up for Charlotte. I don't think he's got something to do with it. I don't think he killed Mama Gary. I don't know. I'm telling you from my heart. I know Bo Salmon didn't kill my mama.
That was back in 1997, though. 20 years later, Beverly is no longer certain about this. When I spoke to her, she told me, "I don't know what to believe anymore." At the time, that night, I thought he was passed out cold and knew nothing of the murder. You couldn't tell me any different. But learning all the shit I've learned over the years about the drugs he was hauling, the things he was doing, and I guess him and Charlotte were fixing the move somewhere. From everything I've seen and heard, both from Beverly herself and those who knew her, I think Beverly doesn't so much have theories about what happened as she has fears about what happened. About whether everything might add up in ways that she might not be able to handle. Especially given the way that Charlotte reacted to Gary's push in the 90s to reopen this case. Beverly was really frustrated by that. Charlotte often wouldn't talk to her, but now Charlotte was seeking her out. In fact, hunting her down at work and telling her to keep quiet, talk to no one. And Beverly wondered why. She had nothing to hide, so who was Charlotte to tell her not to talk?
She turned from down on my job at 12 o'clock at night. She told me not to worry whether I'm the toe that knows what happened. I said, Charlotte, I'm at work. You know, Debbie brought her to where I worked. I said, I gotta go to work. I'm not interested in this shit because, Gary, I'm gonna tell you, I have not been scared from the beginning. I didn't tell my mama. And I know I did.
Charlotte was making things difficult for Beverly, almost as much or more so than Gary was. As Gary pointed out during one call, if Charlotte was willing to tell her family that Beverly had been involved in Grace's death, who else might she tell that?
About Charlotte, if she's told Joan, your aunt, that you killed Grace, what do you think she would tell the authorities if they did close in on her? And they will. Eventually.
Well, I'm sure she would probably say what she told Davy and Whitman. She'd probably tell them that I'm the one done it. I mean, I don't know, you know. What do I do? I mean, what do I do? If I can't remember, what do I do?
But Beverly does recall some things about the night that her mother died, and she remembers one thing in particular very clearly. Where Charlotte was and what Charlotte said. After Beverly finally left her bedroom that night, crept out to the dining room, to the main section of the house. And when she got there, to the living area, on the other side of the kitchen, Beverly saw Charlotte sitting quietly in a dining room chair in the dark.
My menu, if I had to stand before Jesus Christ today, I don't know, I may be wrong, and he knows all. If she didn't do it, she knows who did. I don't know, but I know she was in that living room. I know that night when I walked in that dining room and I said, Charlotte, don't come in here. She said, I've already been in there. And how would she got there quicker than I did when I was closer? And all I was doing was trying to protect my present pregnant sister. She said, I've already seen her. I didn't even know she was sick.
And as much as I'm inclined to distrust Beverly's stories, there's something about this one that stands out to me. Beverly has told this same story nearly word for word in statements 20 years apart. When I talked to Beverly last year, Gary hadn't yet gone through his tape recordings. I didn't know they existed, let alone what Beverly said on them. And when I eventually did listen later on, I realized that what Beverly had told Gary in 1997 was the same thing she told me in 2016. For Beverly, who almost never tells the same story twice, that was striking. She couldn't have known what she said to Gary all those years ago, and she couldn't have known that she had to keep a story consistent between what she said then and what she said to me, because no one knew there was a comparison to even worry about. I think she told me the same story in 2016 that she told Gary in 1997, because it's a real memory that she's held on to, that she's lived with for 42 years.
And I was saying, Charlotte, don't come in here, Charlotte, don't come in here, because I was thinking, you know, she was pregnant, and she didn't need to see Mama laying there. She said, I done seen her.
And when Beverly told me the story, the words were the same, but the emotions were more pronounced. The way Charlotte responded to Beverly that night seems to have been burned forever into Beverly's memory because of the wrongness of it. What seems to stand out the most in Beverly's mind, what still brings her to tears when she recalls it, is just how sarcastic her sister sounded. Beverly began crying when I asked her about it, and though I basically never believe witness reactions and don't put weight in them, I put weight in it this time. I will never believe that Beverly was faking how she responded. She told me, When my sister looked at me that night and told me she'd already been in that kitchen, I've wondered for 42 years. What did she go in there for? What was she doing? And I still today don't know why. My brain just won't let me understand why she went in there. It's the way she said it. I looked at her and said, please, don't go in there. And she said, well, I've already been in there. It's the way it came out. Beverly doesn't know who killed her mother. I can't prove it, but I believe it very much. But I think she has suspicions that cause her to shut down when she tries to think about it.
But I do think Charlotte... Sorry. I'm not sorry. I want to know.
I don't think Charlotte fired any gun that night. It just doesn't explain the evidence we have, or what we know probably definitely happened that night. Like the large bloody footprints in the back hall and one of the bedrooms. They were too big for Gary to have left, and they couldn't have been left by Charlotte. Whatever happened to Grace, it has to explain those footprints and how they got there. And Beverly herself seems to realize there is another way to add up all the facts she knows. Another potential solution that would fit the pieces she's been given.
From that night, I could not think nothing different but Gary killed Mom. Gary, I didn't say you pulled that trigger. That's mad that I actually seen fire come out of the gun. I couldn't say yes. I don't know, reread or whatever. I don't know what the transcript says. I remember what I said. All I said was, you killed my mama.
Yep.
And that's all I can think of. Then I said it might have been Richard Hopper. You and him kind of looked alike if they put y'all up beside each other. Not really, but he kind of looked like you. Sandy hair, big nose. I was just kind of, I was a kid, Gary.
So it's worth noting, Beverly didn't say that at trial or anywhere else. She has never mentioned in any transcript I've seen that the thing she saw that night could have been Richard Holcomb. But she's also never read the transcripts and has a very stilted view of what she actually did say and did not say on the stand. So I wonder if she's remembering here what she wished she'd said, not what she actually did. And then in a different call with Gary later on, she repeated the same story.
But then the other guy said that Richard Holcomb shot her.
Well, if you remember correctly, I said that in court, Gary, that if it wasn't you, that it had to be Richard Holcomb, because y'all look, if you were standing looking at you and him, to me, y'all resembled each other, except for him having that big scar on his face. And I did say that in court, that it could have been Richard Holcomb.
Before she was...
And I'm not saying you were ugly. And Richard Holcomb, to me, was an ugly man, but you know, y'all resembled each other. The hair was about the same color. Y'all were about the same height.
Richard testified that on the night Grace was killed, he left Gary's house before her murder to go sleep at his friend Grady Grigsby's house. Grady Grigsby is dead now, and I can't ask him about it, but in the very detailed records that Gary's sister kept, there is a note to back this up. Grady told one of Gary's brothers that Richard Holcomb had come to his house that night at around 3 a.m., and he was real white, seemed scared, and asked for a drink. So what if it was Richard that Beverly saw that night, and not Gary? Is that what Beverly was hinting at in her conversations with Gary? Because she's right, Gary and Richard don't look alike. Not if you're examining mugshots side by side. Their features were very different. But if you're not considering the details, if you're just looking at height and build and general coloring, well, Richard and Gary aren't that far apart. And if we're to believe what Mystery Man and Ray Allman told Gary all those years ago, then Richard Holcomb had a real loose tongue. He talked a lot, even when he shouldn't. And again, if Ray Allman and Mystery Man are telling the truth, Richard had more knowledge of Grace's murder than he acknowledged having in his testimony at one of the hearings. But maybe Richard Holcomb isn't the only one with a loose tongue, as shown from events that happened later. Bo Salmon was never that worried about covering his tracks, and he often talked a lot. If Bo Salmon was involved in Grace's death, I don't think he would have been totally silent about it.
And I told those people that many years ago, I said, please don't let that man stay in prison. And they said, what do you want us to do? And I said, I want you to make them tell the truth. Get that guy out of prison. Bo did this.
Mm-hmm. that was episode 9 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Gary Mitchum Reeves. Next Monday will be episode 10, the final episode in the series. Though, stay tuned later in the week for a special addendum. As always, don't forget to check out the website for episode transcripts, people maps, timelines, and case materials. And if you'd like to discuss the case, join us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or Reddit. Methyl Tilhan helps produce the show, and our sound editor is Rebecca Lavoie. And by the way, if any of the clips in this episode sound terrible, you can blame me, not her. I wanted them there anyway.